The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
For today, the best of C.M. Kornbluth. The story, Gomez. Now that I'm a cranky, constipated old man, I can afford to say that the younger generation of scientists makes me sick to my stomach. Short order fry cooks of destruction, they hear through the little window the dim order, atom bomb rare with cobalt 60, and sing it back and rattle their stinking skillets and sling the deadly hash, just what the customer ordered, with never a notion invading their smug, too-heated havens that there's a small matter of right and wrong that takes precedence even over their hot cuisine. There used to be a slew of them who yelled to high heaven about it. Viner, Ure, Sizzlard, Morrison, dead now and worse, unfashionable. The greatest of them you have never heard of, Admiral MacDonald, never did clear the story. He was Julio Gomez, and his story was cleared yesterday by a fellow my Jewish friends call Malak Hamavis, the hovering angel of death. A black-bordered letter from Rosa advised me that Malak Hamavis had come in on runway 6 with his flaps down and picked up Julio at the age of 39, pneumonia. But, Rosa painfully wrote, Julio would like you to know he died not too unhappy after a good, thorough, short life with much satisfaction. I think it will give him some more satisfaction wherever he is, to know that his story is at last getting told. It started about 22 years ago with a routine assignment on a crisp October morning. I had an appointment with Dr. Sugarman, the head of the physics department at the university. It was the umpth anniversary of something or other, first atomic pile, the test A bomb, Nagasaki, I don't remember what. And the Sunday editor was putting together a page on it. My job was to interview the three or four university people who were Manhattan District grads. I found Sugarman in his office at the top of the Modest Physics Building's square Gothic tower, brooding through a pointed arch window at the bright autumn sky. He was a tubby, jowly little fellow. I'd been seeing him around for a couple of years at testimonial banquets and press conferences, but I didn't expect him to remember me. He did, though, and even got the name right. Mr. Vilcek, he beamed, from the Tribune. That's right, Dr. Sugarman. How are you? Fine, fine. Sit down, please. Well, what shall we talk about? Well, Dr. Sugarman, I'd really like to have your ideas on the really fundamental issues of atomic energy, A-bomb control, and so on. What, in your opinion, is the single most important factor in these problems? His eyes twinkled. He was going to surprise me. Education, he said, and leaned back, waiting for me to register shock. I registered. That's certainly a different approach, Doctor. How do you mean that exactly? He said impressively, education, technical education, is the key to the underlying issues of our time. I am deeply concerned over the unawareness of the general public to the meaning and accomplishments of science. People underrate me, underrate science. That is, because they do not understand science. Let me show you something. He rummaged for a moment through papers on his desk and handed me a sheet of lined tablet paper covered with chicken track handwriting. A letter I got, he said. I squinted at the penciled scrawl and read, October 12, esteemed sir, beg to introduce self to you, the atomic scientist, as a youth 17 working with diligence to perfect self in mathematical physics. The knowledge of English is imperfect since am in New York 1 year only from Puerto Rico, and due to father and mother, poverty must wash the dishes in the restaurant. So esteemed, sir, excuse imperfect English, which will better. I hesitate intruding your valuable scientist time, but hope you sometimes spare minutes for diligence such as I. My difficulty is with neutron cross-section absorption of boron steel in reactor, which theory I am working out. Breeders, reactors demand, and there's quite a long formula written out, for boron steel compared with neutron cross-section absorption of, and another long formula written out, for any concrete with which I familiarize myself. Whence arises relationship, and again another long formula, indicating only a fourfold breeder gain. Intuitively, I dissatisfy with this gain and beg to intrude your time to ask wherein I neglect, with the most sincere thanks, J. Gomez, care of Portobello Lunchroom, 124th Street and St. Nicholas Ave, New York, New York. I laughed and told Dr. Sugarman appreciatively, that's a good one. I wish our cranks kept in touch with us by email. But they don't. In the newspaper business, they come in and demand to see the editor. Could I use it, by the way? The readers ought to get a boot out of it. He hesitated and said, all right. If you don't use my name, just say a prominent physicist. I didn't think it was too funny myself. But I see your point, of course. The boy may be feeble-minded, and he probably is, but he believes, like too many people, that science is just a bag of tricks that any ordinary person can acquire, and so on and so on. I went back to the office and wrote the interview in 20 minutes. It took me longer than that to talk the Sunday editor into running the Gomez letter in a box on the Atom anniversary page, but he finally saw it my way. I had to retype it. As I just set the letter down to the composing room as was, we would have had a strike on our hands. On Sunday morning at 6:15, I woke up to the tune of fists thundering on my hotel room door. I found my slippers and bathrobe and lurched blearily across the room. They didn't wait for me to unlatch. The door opened. I saw one of the hotel clerks, the Sunday editor, a frosty-faced old man, and three hard-faced, hard-eyed young men. The hotel clerk mumbled and retreated, and the others moved in. Chief, I asked the Sunday editor hazily, what's going on? A hard-faced young man was standing with his back to the door. Another was standing with his back to the window. And the third was blocking the bathroom door. The icy old man interrupted me with a crisp, authoritative question, snapped at the editor. You identify this man as Vilcek? The editor nodded. Search him, snapped the old man. The fellow standing guard at the window slipped up and frisked me for weapons while I sputtered incoherently, with the Sunday editor avoiding my eye. When the search was over, the frosty-faced old boy said to me, I am Rear Admiral MacDonald, Mr. Vilcek. I'm here in my capacity as Deputy Director of the Office of Security and Intelligence, U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. Did you write this? He thrust a newspaper clipping at my face. I read blearingly, What's so tough about a science? Teenage pot washer doesn't know. A letter received recently by a prominent local atomic scientist points up Dr. Sugarman's complaint, see adjoining column, that the public does not appreciate how hard a physicist works. The text, complete with mathematics, follows. Esteemed sir, beg to introduce self to you, the atomic scientist, as youth 17, working. Yes, I told the admiral I wrote it, except for the headline. What about it? He snapped. The letter is purportedly from a New York youth seeking information, yet there is no address for him given. Why is that? I said patiently. I left it off when I copied it for the composing room. That's trib style on reader's letters. What is all this about? He ignored the question and asked, where is the purported original of the letter? I thought hard and told him, I think I stuck it in my pants pocket. I'll get it. I started for the chair with my suit draped over it. Hold it, mister, said the young man at the bathroom door. I held it, and he proceeded to go through the pockets of the suit. He found the Gomez letter in the inside breast pocket of the coat and passed it to the admiral. The old man compared it word for word with the clipping and then put them both in his pocket. I want to thank you for your cooperation, he said coldly to me and the Sunday editor. I caution you not to discuss and above all not to publish any account of this incident. The national security is involved in the highest degree. Good day. He and his boy started for the door and the Sunday editor came to life. Admiral, he said, this is going to be on the front page of tomorrow's Trib. The admiral went white. After a long pause, he said, you are aware that this country may be plunged into global war at any moment, that American boys are dying every day in border skirmishes. Is it to protect civilians like you who won't obey a reasonable request affecting security? The Sunday editor took a seat on the edge of my rumpled bed and lit a cigarette. I know all that, Admiral, he said. I also know that this is a free country and how to keep it that way. Pitiless light on incidents like this of illegal search and seizure. The admiral said, I personally assure you on my honor as an officer that you would be doing this country a grave disservice by publishing an account of this. The Sunday editor said mildly, your honor as an officer, you broke into this room without a search warrant. Don't you realize that's against the law? And I saw your boy ready to shoot when Vilichek started for that chair. I began to sweat a little at that, but the admiral was sweating harder. With an effort, he said, I should apologize for the abruptness and discourtesy with which I've treated you. I do apologize. My only excuse is that, as I've said, this is a crash priority matter. May I have your assurance that you gentlemen will keep silent? On one condition, said the Sunday editor. I want the Trib to have an exclusive on the Gomez story. I want Mr. Vilichek to cover it with your full cooperation. In return, we'll hold it for your release and submit it to your security censorship. It's a deal, said the admiral sourly. He seemed to realize suddenly that the Sunday editor had been figuring on such a deal all along. On the plane for New York, the admiral filled me in. He was precise and unhappy, determined to make the best of a bad job. I was awakened at 3 this morning by a phone call from the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. He had been awakened by a call from Dr. Monroe of the Scientific Advisory Committee. Dr. Monroe had been up late working and sent out for the Sunday Tribune to read before going to sleep. He saw the Gomez letter and went off like a 16-inch rifle. The neutron cross-section absorption relationship expressed in it happens to be, Mr. Vilcek, his own work. It also happens to be one of the nation's most closely guarded atomic secrets. Presumably, this Gomez stumbled on it somehow as a janitor or something of the sort, and is feeding his ego by pretending to be an atomic scientist. I scratched my unshaved jaw. Admiral, I said, you wouldn't kid me. How can three equations be a top atomic secret? The admiral hesitated. All I can tell you, he said slowly, is that breeder reactors are involved. But the letter said that. You mean this Gomez not only swiped the equations but knew what they were about? The admiral said grimly, somebody has been incredibly lax. It would be worth many divisions to the Soviet for their man Kapitsa to see these equations and realize that they are valid. He left me to chew that one over for a while as the plane droned over New Jersey. Finally, the pilot called back, ETA, 5 minutes, sir. We have landing priority at Newark. Good, said the admiral. Signal for a civilian-type car to pick up without loss of time. Civilian, I said. Of course, civilian, he snapped. That's the hell of it. Above all, we must not arouse suspicion that there is anything special or unusual about this Gomez or his letter. Copies of the Tribune are on their way to the Soviet now as a matter of routine. They take all American papers and magazines they can get. If we tried to stop shipment of Tribunes, that would be an immediate giveaway that there was something of importance going on. We landed, and the five of us got into a late-model car, neither drab nor flashy. One of the admiral's young men relieved the driver, a corporal with Signal Corps insignia. There wasn't much talk during the drive from Newark to Spanish Harlem, New York. Just once the admiral lit a cigarette, but he flicked it through the window after a couple of nervous puffs. The Portobello Lunchroom was a storefront restaurant in the middle of a shabby tenement block. Wide-eyed, graceful, skinny little kids stared as our car parked in front of it and then converged on us purposefully. "Watch your car, mister," they begged. The admiral surprised them and me with a flood of Spanish that sent the little extortionists scattering back to their stickball game in the street and their potsy layouts chalked on the sidewalks. "Higgins," said the admiral, "see if there's a back exit." One of his boys got out and walked around the block under the dull and curious eyes of black-shawled women sitting on their stoops. He was back in 5 minutes, shaking his head. "Vilcek and I will go in," said the admiral. "Higgins, stand by the restaurant door and tackle anyone who comes flying out." "Let's go, reporter, and remember that I do the talking." The noon-hour crowd at the Portobello's 10 tables looked up at us when we came in. The admiral said to a woman at a primitive cashier's table, "Nueva York, Board of Health, senora." "Ah," she muttered angrily, "por favor, no aquí." "In back, understand? Come." She beckoned a pretty waitress to take over at the cash drawer and led us into the steamy little kitchen. It was crowded with us, an old cook and a young dishwasher. The admiral and the woman began a rapid exchange of Spanish. He played his part well. I myself couldn't keep my eyes off the kid dishwasher, who somehow or other had got hold of one of America's top atomic secrets. Gomez was 17, but he looked 15. He was small-boned and lean, with skin the color of bright Virginia tobacco in an English cigarette. His hair was straight and glossy black and a little long. Every so often he wiped his hands on his apron and brushed it back from his damp forehead. He was working like hell, dipping and swabbing and rinsing and drying like a machine, but he didn't look pushed or angry. He wore a half-smile that I later found out was his normal, relaxed expression, and his eyes were far away from the kitchen of the Portobello lunchroom. The elderly cook was making it clear by the exaggerated violence of his gesture and a savage frown that he resented these people invading his territory. I don't think Gomez even knew we were there. A sudden, crazy idea came into my head. The admiral had turned to him. ¿Cómo se llama, chico? He started and put down the dish he was wiping. Julio Gomez, señor. ¿Por qué, por favor? ¿Qué pasa? He wasn't the least bit scared. Nueva York Board of Health, said the admiral. Con su permiso. He took Gomez's hands into his and looked at them, gravely, front and back, making tisk-tisk noises. Then decisively, Vámonos, Julio. Siento mucho. Usted está muy enfermo. Everybody started talking at once, the woman doubtless objecting to the slur on her restaurant and the cook to lose his dishwasher and Gomez to losing time from the job. The admiral gave them broadside for broadside and outlasted them. In 5 minutes, we were leading Gomez silently from the restaurant. La loteria, a woman customer in a loud whisper. O las mutas, somebody said back. Arrested for policy or marijuana, they thought. The pretty waitress at the cashier's table looked stricken and said nervously, Julio? As we passed, but he didn't notice. Gomez sat in the car with a half smile on his lips and the eyes a million miles away as we rolled downtown to Foley Square. The admiral didn't look as though he'd approve of any questions from me. We got out at the federal building and Gomez spoke at last. He said in surprise, It is not the hospital. Nobody answered. We marched him up the steps and surrounded him in the elevator. It would have made anybody nervous. It would have made me nervous to be herded like that. Everybody's got something on his conscience, but the kid didn't even seem to notice. I decided that he must be a half-wit, or there came that crazy notion again. The glass door said U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, Office of Security and Intelligence. The people behind it were flabbergasted when the admiral and party walked in. He turned the head man out of his office and sat at his desk, with Gomez getting the caller's chair. The rest of us stationed ourselves uncomfortably around the room. It started. The admiral produced the letter and asked in English, Have you ever seen this before? He made it clear from the way he held it that Gomez wasn't going to get his hands on it. Sí, seguro. I wrote it last week. This is funny business. I am not really sick like you say, no? He seemed relieved. No. Where did you get these equations? Gomez said proudly. I worked them out. The admiral gave a disgusted little laugh. Don't waste my time, boy. Where did you get these equations? Gomez was beginning to get upset. You got no right to call me liar, he said. I not so smart as the big physicist, seguro, and maybe I make mistakes. Maybe I waste the professor Suharman his time, but he got no right to have me arrest. I tell him right in letter, he don't have to answer if he doesn't want to. I make no crime and you got no right. The admiral looked bored. Tell me how you worked out the equations, he said. Okay, said Gomez sulkily. You know, the random paths of neutron is expressed in matrix mechanics by Professor Oppenheim 5 years ago. All okay. I transform his equations from path prediction domain to cross-section domain and integrate over absorption areas. That gives U-series and V-series. And from there, the U-V relationship is obvious, no? The admiral, still bored, asked, Got it? I noticed that one of his young men had a short pad out. "Yes," he said. The admiral picked up the phone and said, "This is MacDonald. Get me Dr. Mines out at Brookhaven right away." He told Gomez blandly, "Dr. Mines is the chief of the AEC Theoretical Physics Division. I'm going to ask him what he thinks of the way you worked it and the equations. He's going to tell me that you were just spouting a lot of gibberish, and then you're going to tell me where you really got them." Gomez looked mixed up, and the admiral turned back to the phone. "Dr. Mines, this is Admiral MacDonald of Security. I want your opinion on the following." He snapped his fingers impatiently, and the stenographer passed him his pad. "Someone has told me that he discovered a certain relationship by taking," he read carefully, "by taking the random paths of a neutron expressed in matrix mechanics by Oppenheimer, transforming his equations from the path prediction domain to the cross-section domain and integrating over the absorption areas." In the silence of the room, I could hear the faint buzz of the voice on the other end, and a giant red blush spread over the admiral's face from his brow to his neck. The faintly buzzing voice ceased, and after a long pause, the admiral said slowly and softly, "No, it wasn't Fermi or Szilard. I'm not at liberty to tell you who. Can you come right down to the Federal Building Security Office in New York? I need your help. Crash priority." He hung up the phone wearily and muttered to himself, "Crash priority, crash," and wandered out of the office looking dazed. His young men stared at one another in frank astonishment. "5 years," said one. "And nix," said another, looking pointedly at me. Gomez asked brightly, "What goes on anyhow? This is damn funny business, I think." "Relax, kid," I told him. "Looks as if you'll make out all nix," said the nixer again savagely, and I shut up and waited. After a while, somebody came in with coffee and sandwiches, and we ate them. After another while, the admiral came in with Dr. Mines. Mines was a white-haired, wrinkled Connecticut Yankee. All I knew about him was that he'd been in mild trouble with Congress for stubbornly plugging world government and getting on some of the wrong letterheads. But I learned right away that he was all scientist and didn't have a phony bone in his body. "Mr. Gomez," he asked cheerfully, "the admiral tells me that you are either a well-trained Russian spy or a phenomenal self-taught nuclear physicist. He wants me to find out which." "Russia!" yelled Gomez, outraged. "He crazy. I am American, United States citizen." "That's as may be," said Dr. Mines. "Now, the admiral tells me you described the U-V relationship as obvious. I should call it a highly abstruse derivation in the theory of continued fractions and complex multiplication." Gomez strangled and gargled helplessly, trying to talk, and finally asked, his eyes shining, "Por favor, could I have a piece of paper?" They got him a stack of paper, and the party was on. For 2 unbroken hours, Gomez and Dr. Mines chattered and scribbled. Mines gradually shed his jacket, vest, and tie, completely oblivious to the rest of us. Gomez was even more abstracted. He didn't shed his jacket, vest, and tie. He didn't seem to be aware of anything except the rapid-fire exchange of ideas via scribbled formulas and the terse-spoken jargon of mathematics. Dr. Mines shifted on his chair, and sometimes his voice rose with excitement. Gomez didn't shift or wriggle or cross his legs. He just sat up and scribbled and talked in a low, rapid monotone, looking straight at Dr. Mines with his eyes very wide open and lit up like searchlights. The rest of us just watched and wondered. Dr. Mines broke at last. He stood up and says, "I can't take it anymore, Gomez. I gotta think it over. He began to leave the room, mechanically scooping up his clothes, and then realized that we were still there. "Well?" asked the Admiral grimly. Dr. Mines smiled apologetically. "He's a physicist, all right," he said. Gomez sat up abruptly and looked astonished. "Take him into the next office, Higgins," said the Admiral. Gomez let himself be led away like a sleepwalker. Dr. Mines began to chuckle. "Security," he said. "Security." The Admiral rasped, "Don't trouble yourself over my decisions, if you please, Dr. Mines. My job is keeping the Soviets from pirating American science, and I'm doing it to the best of my ability. What I want from you is your opinion on the possibility of that young man having worked out the equations as he claimed." Dr. Mines was abruptly sobered. "Yes," he said. "Unquestionably he did. And will you excuse my remark? I was under some strain in trying to keep up with Gomez." "Certainly," said the Admiral, and managed a frosty smile. "Now, if you'll be so good as to tell me how this completely impossible thing can have happened." "It's happened before, Admiral," said Dr. Mines. "I don't suppose you've ever heard of Ramanujan."
"No."
"Srinivasa Ramanujan?"
"No."
"Oh, well, he was born in 1887 and died in 1920. He was a poor Hindu who failed twice in college and then settled down as a government clerk with only a single obsolete textbook to go on. He made himself a very great mathematician. In 1913, he sent some of his original work to a Cambridge professor. He was immediately recognized and called to England, where he was accepted as a first-rank man, became a member of the Royal Society, a Fellow of Trinity, and so forth." The Admiral shook his head dazedly. "It happens," Dr. Mines said. "Oh, yes, it happens. Ramanujan had only one out-of-date book, but this is New York. Gomez has access to all the mathematics he could hope for, and a great mass of unclassified and declassified nuclear data. And genius. The way he puts things together. He seems to have only the vaguest notion of what a proof should be. He sees relationships as a whole. A most convenient faculty which I envy him. Where I have to take, say, a dozen painful steps from one conclusion to the next, he achieves it in one grand flying leap." "Ramanujan was like that too, by the way. Very strong on intuition, weak on what we call rigor." Dr. Mines noted with a start that he was holding his tie, vest, and coat in one hand and then began to put them on. "Was there anything else?" he asked politely. "One thing," said the Admiral. "Would you say he's a better physicist than you are?" "Yes," said Dr. Mines, "much better." And he left. The Admiral slumped uncharacteristically at the desk for a long time. Finally, he said to the air, "Somebody get me the general manager. No, the chairman of the commission." One of his boys grabbed the phone and got to work on the call. "Admiral," I said, "where do we stand now?" "Oh, it's you. The matter's out of my hands now since no security violation is involved. I consider Gomez to be in my custody and I shall turn him over to the commission so that he may be put to the best use in the nation's interest." "Like a machine?" I asked, disgusted. He gave me both barrels of his ice blue eyes. "Like a weapon," he said evenly. He was right, of course. Didn't I know there was a war on? Of course I did. Who didn't? Taxes, housing, shortage, somebody's cousin killed in Korea, everybody's kid brother sweating out the draft, prices sky high at the supermarket. Uncomfortably, I scratched my unshaved chin and walked to the window. Foley Square below was full of Sunday peace, with only a single girl stroller to be seen. She walked the length of the block across the street from the federal building and then turned and walked back. Her walk was dragging and hopeless and tragic. Suddenly, I knew her. She was the pretty little waitress from the Portobello. She must have hopped a cab and followed the men who were taking her Giulio away. Might as well beat it, sister, I told her silently. Giulio isn't just a good-looking kid anymore. He's a military asset. The security office is turning him over to the policy-level boys for disposal. When that happens, you might as well give up and go home. It was as if she'd heard me. Holding a silly little handkerchief to her face, she turned and ran blindly for the subway at the end of the block and disappeared into it. At that moment, the telephone rang. "McDonald here," said the admiral. "I'm ready to report on the Gomez affair, Mr. Commissioner." Gomez was a minor, so his parents signed a contract for him. The job description on the contract didn't matter, but he got a pretty good salary by government standards and a per diem allowance, too. I signed a contract, too. Information specialist. I was partly companion, partly historian, and partly a guy they'd rather have their eyes on than not. When somebody tried to cut me out on grounds of economy, Admiral McDonald frostily reminded them that he had given his word. I stayed for all the good it did me. We didn't have any name. We weren't Operation Anything or Project Who's This or Tax Force Dinwiddie. We were just five people in a big 15-room house on the outskirts of Milford, New Jersey. There was Gomez, alone on the top floor, with a lot of books, technical magazines, and blackboards, and a weekly visit from Dr. Mines. There were the three security men, Higgins, Dalhousie, and Lester, sleeping by turns and prowling the grounds. And there was me. From briefing sessions with Dr. Mines, I kept a diary of what went on. Don't think from that I knew what the score was. War correspondents have told me of the frustrating life they led at some closed-mouth commands. So-and-so, many air sorties, the largest number since January 15th, casualties a full 15% lighter than expected, determined advance in an active sector against relatively strong enemy opposition, and so on and so on, all adding up to nothing in the way of real information. That's what it was like in my diary, because that's all they told me. Here are some excerpts. On the recommendation of Dr. Mines, Mr. Gomez today began work on a phase of reactor design theory to be implemented at Brookhaven National Laboratory. The work involves the setting up of 35 pairs of partial differential equations. Mr. Gomez announced tentatively today that in checking through certain theoretical work in progress at the Los Alamos Laboratory of the AEC, he discovered a fallacious assumption concerning neutron spin, which invalidates the conclusions reached. This will be communicated to the library. Dr. Mines said today that Mr. Gomez has successfully invoked a hitherto unexploited aspect of Minkowski's tensor analysis to crack a stubborn obstacle toward the control of thermonuclear reactions. I protested at one of these briefing sessions with Dr. Mines against this gobbledygook. He didn't mind my protesting. He leaned back in his chair and said calmly, "Vilcek, with all friendliness, I assure you that you're getting everything you can understand. Anything more complex than the vague description of what's going on would be over your head, and anything more specific would give away exact engineering information, which would be of use to foreign countries." "This isn't the way they treated Bill Lawrence when he covered the atomic bomb," I said bitterly. Mines nodded, and with a pleased smile. "That's it, exactly," he said. "Broad principles were being developed then. interesting things that could be told without any great harm being done. If you tell somebody that a critical mass of U-235 or plutonium goes off with a big bang, you really haven't given away a great deal. He still has millions of man-hours of engineering before him to figure out how much is critical mass to take only one small point. So I took his word for it, faithfully copied the communiques he gave me, and wrote that I could, on the human interest side, for release someday. So I recorded Gomez's progress with English, his taste for chicken pot pie and rice pudding, his habit of doing his own housework on the top floor, and his old maidish neatness. "You live your first 15 years in a tin shack, Beale," he told me once, "and you find out you like things nice and clean." I've seen Dr. Mines follow Gomez through the top floor as the boys swept and dusted, talking at him in their mathematical jargon. Gomez worked in 48-hour spells, usually, and not eating much. Then for a couple of days, he'd live like a human being, grabbing naps, playing catch on the lawn with one or another of the security people, talking with me about his childhood in Puerto Rico and his youth in New York. He taught me a little Spanish and asked me to catch him up on bad mistakes in English. "But don't you ever want to get out of here?" I demanded one day. He grinned. "Why should I, Beale? Here I eat good. I can send money to the parents. Best I find out what the big professors are up to without I have to wait 5-10 years for damn declassifying." "Don't you have a girl?" He was embarrassed and changed the subject back to the big professors. Dr. Mines drove up then with his chauffeur, who looked like his G-man, and almost certainly was. As usual, the physicist was toting a bulging briefcase. After a few polite words with me, he and Julio went indoors and upstairs. They were closeted for 5 hours, a record. When Dr. Mines came down, I expected the usual briefing session, but he begged off. "Nothing serious," he said. "We just sat down and kicked some ideas of his around. I told him to go ahead. We've been using him very much like a sort of computer, you know, turning him loose on the problems that were too tough for me and some of the other men. He's got the itch for research now. It would be very interesting if his forte turned out to be creative." I agreed. Julio didn't come down for dinner. I woke up in darkness that night when there was a loud bump overhead and went upstairs in my pajamas. Gomez was sprawled, fully dressed, on the floor. He'd tripped over a footstool, and he didn't seem to have noticed. His lips were moving, and he stared straight at me without knowing I was there. "You all right, Julio?" I asked, and started to help him to his feet. He got up mechanically and said, "Real values of the zeta function vanish. How's that?" He saw me then and asked, puzzled, "How you get in here, Beale? Is dinner time?" "It's 4 a.m., por Dios. Don't you think you ought to get some sleep?" He looked terrible. No, he didn't think he ought to get some sleep. He had some work to do. I went downstairs and heard him pacing overhead for an hour until I dozed off. This splurge of work didn't wear off in 48 hours. For a week, I brought him meals, and sometimes he ate absently with one hand as he scribbled on a yellow pad. Sometimes I'd bring him lunch to find his breakfast untouched. He didn't have much beard, but he let it grow for a week. Too busy to shave, too busy to talk, too busy to eat, sleeping in chairs when fatigue caught up with him. I asked Letzer, badly worried, if he should do anything about it. He had a direct scrambler phone call connection with the New York Security and Intelligence Office, but his orders didn't cover anything like a self-induced nervous breakdown of the man he was guarding. I thought Dr. Mines would do something when he came. Call in an MD or tell Gomez to take it easy or take some of the load off by parceling out whatever he had by the tail. But he didn't. He went upstairs, came down 2 hours later, and absently tried to walk past me. I headed him off into my room. "What's the word?" I demanded. He looked me in the eye and said defiantly, "He's doing fine. I don't want to stop him." Dr. Mines was a good man. Dr. Mines was a humane man, and he wouldn't lift a finger to keep the boy from working himself into nervous prostration. Dr. Mines liked people well enough, but he reserved his love for the theoretical physics. How important can this thing be? He shrugged irritably. "It's just the way some scientists work," he said. "Newton was like that. So was Sir William Rowan Hamilton." "Hamilton Schmamilton," I said. "What's the sense of it? Why doesn't he sleep or eat?" Mines said, "You don't know what it's like." "Of course," I said, getting good and sore. "I'm just a dumb newspaper man. Tell me, Mr. Bones, what is it like?" There was a long pause, and he said mildly, "I'll try." "That boy up there is using his brain. A great chess player can put on a blindfold and play 100 opponents in 100 games simultaneously, remembering all the positions of his pieces and theirs, and keeping 100 strategies clear in his mind. Well, that stunt simply isn't in the same league with what Julio's doing up there. He has in his head some millions of facts concerning theoretical physics. He's scanning them, picking out one here and there, fitting them into the new relationships, checking and rejecting when he has to, fitting the new relationship together, turning them upside down and inside out to see what happens, comparing them with known doctrine, holding them in his memory while he repeats the whole process and compares, and all the while he has a goal firmly in mind against which he's measured all these things. He seemed to be finished. For a reporter, I felt strangely shy. "What's he driving at?" I asked. "I think," he said slowly, "he's approaching a unified field theory." Apparently, that was supposed to explain everything. I let Dr. Mines know that it didn't. He said thoughtfully, "I don't know whether I can get it over to a layman. No offense, Vilcek. Let's put it this way. You know how math comes in waves and how it's followed by waves of applied science based on the math. There was a big wave of algebra in the Middle Ages. Following it came navigation, gunnery, surveying, and so on. Then the Renaissance and a wave of analysis, what you'd call calculus. That opened up steam power and how to use it, mechanical engineering, electricity. The wave of modern mathematics says, since 1875, gave us atomic energy. That boy upstairs may be starting off the next big wave." He got up and reached for his hat. "Just a minute," I said. I was surprised that my voice was steady. "What comes next? Control of gravity? Control of personality? Sending people by radio?" Dr. Mines wouldn't meet my eyes. Suddenly, he looked old and shrunken. "Don't worry about the boy," he said. I let him go. That evening, I brought Gomez chicken pot pie and a non-alcoholic eggnog. He drank the eggnog and said, "Hi, Bill," and continued to cover yellow sheets of paper. I went downstairs and worried. Abruptly, it ended late the next afternoon. Gomez wandered into the big first-floor kitchen looking like a starved old rickshaw coolie. He pushed his hair back from his forehead, said, "Bill, what is to eat?" and pitched forward onto the linoleum. Letzer came in when I yelled expertly took Gomez's pulse, rolled him into a blanket, and threw another one over him. "It's just a faint," he said. "Let's get him to bed." "Aren't you going to call a doctor, man?" "Doctor couldn't do anything we can't do," he said stolidly. and I'm here to see that security isn't breached. Give me a hand. We got him upstairs and put him to bed. He woke up and said something in Spanish and then apologetically, "Very sorry, fellows. I ought to take it easier." "I'll get you some lunch," I said, and he grinned. He ate it all, enjoying it heartily, and finally lay back gorged. "Well," he asked me, "what is new, Beale?" "What is new?" "And you should tell me. You finish your work." "I got it in shape to finish. The hard part is over." He rolled out of bed. "Hey," I said. "I'm okay now," he grinned. "Don't write this down in your history, Beale. Everybody will think I act like a woman." I followed him into his workroom, where he flopped into an easy chair, his eyes on a blackboard covered with figures. He wasn't grinning anymore. "Dr. Mines says you're up to something big," I said. "Si, big." "Unified field theory," he says. "That is it," Gomez said. "Is it good or bad?" I asked, licking my lips. "The application, I mean." His boyish mouth set suddenly in a grim line. "That it is not my business," he said. "I am American citizen of the United States." He stared at the blackboard and its maze of notes. I looked at it too, really looked at it for once, and was surprised by what I saw. Mathematics, of course, I don't know, but I had soaked up a very little about mathematics. One of the things I had soaked up was that the expressions of higher mathematics tend to be complicated and elaborate, involving English, Greek, and Hebrew letters, plain and fancy brackets, and a great variety of special signs, besides the plus and minus of the elementary school. The things on the blackboard weren't like that at all. The board was covered with variations of a simple expression that consisted of five letters and two symbols, a right-handed pot hook and a left-handed pot hook. "What do they mean?" I asked, pointing. "Something I made up," he said nervously. "The word for the one is Enfields, the other one is Enfielded by." "What's that mean?" His luminous eyes were haunted. He didn't answer. "It looks like simple stuff. I read somewhere that all the basic stuff is simple once it's been discovered." "Yes," he said almost inaudibly. "It is simple, Beale. Too damn simple, I think. Better I carry it in my head, I think." He strode to the blackboard and erased it instinctively. I half rose to stop him. He gave me a bitter grin that was somehow bitter and unlike him. "Don't worry," he said. "I don't forget it." He tapped his forehead. "I can't forget it. I hope I never see again on any face the look that was on his." Get ready for part two next week, where we can finish this interesting story. Thanks for listening.